Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today on our show, we're going to talk about The Photograph and The Gentleman.
Two movies that have nothing in common.
Nothing whatsoever.
Usually we look for like smooth segues, but you know, honestly, there's no segue here. But apples and oranges, as I call it. But you know, let's talk about The Photograph first.
All right. I will say both movies seem to be aimed at an older demographic than the 25-year-old man.
I don't entirely agree on that. I would say The Photograph probably so. The Gentleman, with the nature of its director and the storyline and characterizations, I think can pull people and has pulled people across generational lines, but I think it's actually like young guys in particular who would sort of get off on or enjoy it there. But that's something we can talk about.
Okay. Well, we'll start with The Photograph. Where do you want to start with that?
Maybe by way of genre, why don't you set us up that way in terms of the type of story?
Well, I would say I would classify it as a romantic story.
But demographically?
Well, it's a story where everybody in it is African American.
That's crucial. We can't act like color does matter, right? We can't say we're totally colorblind. And you know, like joking aside on that.
And it's linked stories between two generations where you find out about the past, you find out what advises the present.
But see, I always want to talk about color when other people don't want to talk about color.
Well, let's just talk about it.
Well, the reason, like joking and not joking there, because it seems to me that so often in terms of characters of color on screen, it's nice to have that happen more often now, but also by way of what I call normalcy. You know what I'm getting at? Normalizing. So that what traditionally would have been white characters there, that it can be presented, and then ironically, when that becomes more frequent, more common, as it is, finally, belatedly, that at some point it would become irrelevant to point it out as I'm pointing it out. Know what I mean? I would love to have my conversation be obsolete here. The fact that you could just say it's a love story. Because I still notice in our culture oftentimes, if you take a romance like this and you've seen it and you're describing it to friends, and I don't mean you personally, but like you generically, the fact that there's a tendency is if the characters are white, we don't say, and then this white guy falls in love with this white girl. You know, it's just, well, they're these black people. And in other words, it still tends to be a cultural marker that way. And then what we could talk about further is, of course, the extent to which it does and should matter by way of things that are culturally specific, you know, that sometimes would set one group apart from another, and not necessarily in either a positive or negative way, but just simply that, you know, the food we have on our table might not be the same as the food on your table kind of thing.
I also like the fact that, and I think one of the reasons why this movie bubbled up is that you finally get a chance to see people you've seen in other things make another movie. So I think the fact that it has Lakeith Stanfield in it is important because he's been all over the place and stuff. You know, I just saw him in Knives Out. So it's good to see him again. It's like, you know, you just recently saw him. It's like, you know, he came back before you had a chance to miss him. And also Issa Rae, I've seen lately in a lot of things. I feel like her career is at a really pivotal place because she was good in Little. She also does the voice in the animated short Hair Love, which won Best
I'm so glad it won. In fact, it's too late to really talk about the Oscars per se, but I saw all the nominated films and all the short film categories. And when I went to see the program of animated shorts, it was a week or so before the Oscar ceremony. And the moment I saw that film, I thought, that's the winner.
Yeah.
And it really, it's endearing. It's just a lovely short film. And the vocal talent is so well deployed there. And I share your feelings for these actors. And my sense along those same lines is, I've been seeing these people for a while, right? And when, you know, that, like, in terms of seeing these people, as in you're just going to the movies. You're not looking like, I want to see the next, you know, Lakeith Stanfield film. You know what I mean? I'm not going with that as like the reason I get in the car kind of thing. But simply that, you know, I go to a film and let's say it's like the first or second time you see one of these actors on screen. And when I find myself asking, well, who are these people? Who is this actor? Like, maybe I've seen her before. Like it almost as if like the fog is clearing in the head kind of feeling. Like, this is an actor who's relatively new to the scene, and maybe I've seen one or two roles. And what I'm getting at there is I can't quite get a fix on the actor yet, right? It's just like, here's somebody who's becoming familiar. And so being a diligent student, I say, okay, now I should, like, memorize the name and how to spell it even, right? I should learn these people. And then what happens, and I find it quite wonderful, is I might just be going to another movie like a week or two later or a month later. And again, not, you know, I'm thinking of top of the line talent or whatever gets me to the theater. And then as I'm watching it, oh my God, I just saw her last month. You know, that feeling, which is a really nice feeling to have. And at that point, someone who was just like, who is this person kind of thing is like, I sort of know this person now. And frankly, I'm kind of rooting for the actor at that point because these are good performances, nice, solid performances, promising ones, let's put it that way. And that's such a frequent occurrence that without being cynical about it, sometimes you get those fresh faces that a year or two later, it's like, well, who was that? Or somehow they slid into something else. Maybe just providing voices for video games or something, you know, they've gone somewhere else. And not everyone lands, to put it that way. Not everyone becomes a presence. And both actors that you mentioned have been doing enough good work that at this point, yeah, I mean, they now become the reason to go see the film, you know, and so I'm kind of rooting for them that way. I have no financial stake in this, but I'm just sort of rooting for them because these are actors I like. And honestly, it's a bit of a parlor game, too, as in who will have real lasting power. Will we still be talking about them, you know, 10 years from now? And of course, that's all conjecture, but by way of what makes a star a star, because it goes beyond just acting talent. I mean, they're both photogenic. That doesn't hurt. They both have real talent, and they have the thing that you can't quite put words on, which is a hindrance on radio, I realize, that they have chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And chemistry, it's either there or it's not there, right? We know it now as you and I are talking in terms of politics. You can think of politicians whether you agree or disagree with them. Some of them are not exactly charismatic. And even if you agree with their policy papers, you kind of yawn as you press the lever, right? It's just like, yeah, I agree with him or her, but oh my God, I'm falling asleep here. Before I fall asleep, let me press the lever that I agree with. Because there's something about the presence that person has or doesn't have. The difference between a politician who really knows how to light up an audience and somebody else who's not a very good retail politician, as they say, who has, you know, the right positions perhaps, but not the right persona. And the reason I go on that little sidetrack isn't just because we're in political season, but simply that there are analogies there with actors in terms of who's really got the chops, but that doesn't necessarily make you a lasting presence. You know, you need to connect on some other level that ultimately is a sort of nonverbal, like there's certain actors you like, mm-hmm. right? The moment you see that image, you like that person. And to only a certain degree can you verbalize it. Beyond that, it's just, I like this one more than that one.
It reminds me though of the star system, you know, back in the day. You would see actors in small roles and then finally, you know, they'd have their chance to carry the movie. Cuz like I said, Lakeith Stanfield has been in everything lately. He was in Uncut Gems and
oh, that's right. Yeah.
And he was in Get Out.
Yes.
And
yes.
Knives Out, and these are all movies where he's not the lead.
A lot of Out movies.
You remember? Yes, he's in a lot of Out movies. But you know, he doesn't carry it. But then to have him play the lead in this was like, oh, there's Lakeith again.
Yeah, but
this time I'm glad to see he's the star.
But you know what? And this is to flip the equation. I agree with you completely, but to flip the equation hypothetically, sometimes you'll have an actor like that who's just simply a journeyman. You know what I mean? That you're going to
try everything.
Yeah, a good character actor. You're going to see this person over the years and somehow just doesn't ignite, right? Reliable, it's true, but never breaks out of that. These two actors, fortunately, are blessed with the fact that they've been noticed in the way you and I are noticing them. You don't just say, well, who are these people? Well, yeah, I know, I recognize these people now, and now I'm going to see the movie because of these people, because of them, that they are really endearing, charismatic, and so on. And I think it's a happy moment because when you see the photograph, you can envision in the next year or two, they'll be, you know, top billed, right? They won't just, like in Knives Out, it's a great ensemble cast. And there are a lot of well-known actors there, but some of them just kind of like do their scenes. They shuffle in and out and make you smile and so on. But it's not ultimately the reason you're going to see the film. You know, it's just, you know, there are at least a half dozen people that are drawing cards, right? You're not going just to see, you know, the actors we're talking about. But that's all changing as we speak. I mean, we're going to go see movies because of these actors who don't have actually, you know, when you mention the old star system, go back. You know, as recently as 40, 50 years ago when the studio system was still kind of sort of still around and go back a little earlier when it was definitely still around, they both would have had their names changed.
That's true.
In the old studio days, those are not marquee names. You know what I mean? You wouldn't have. But now, if you can have Benedict Cumberbatch as a movie star, any name can
any
go.
Name
can go on the marquee at this point. I'm trying fitting on the marquee for starters. It would have been truncated for sure, right? But you know, like joking aside on that, you know, when you think of what makes for a good movie star name, I mean, you know, would you go to see Archie Leach or Cary Grant? Well, I'll go to see Cary Grant. And so in terms of names being changed for various reasons, nowadays, and I smile about this all the time, and it's ultimately a good thing. I mean, you know, you should keep your real name almost always, right? That's who you are. And if you're a good actor, people will go to see you. But I do kind of smile about it because back in the studio era, a studio PR person would have changed your name while you were having lunch.
That's true. I'd like to say a little bit about Issa Rae. I think we talked about Little when it came out.
We did, actually.
And I really liked her in that. She was she got to be the same age for the whole movie. But, you know, it would have been more logical to cast a Tiffany Haddish or Taraji Hansen in this because they're more well-known. But I think it was a stroke of genius to cast Issa Rae, who, by the way, grew up in Potomac, Maryland. So kind of a local girl. And she went to Stanford and majored in African and African-American studies. And she has interesting things to say about the way black characters are portrayed. She says on TV, they're always the sidekicks or they're insignificant. You could put all the black sidekicks on one show and it would be the most boring one-dimensional show ever. They're always the archetype of the large black woman on television, snide and sassy. She does not play a character like that on this. She says, I want to be the black Tina Fey, where I am just able to produce my own content and produce other content for other minority filmmakers and put their voices on screen and basically be able to have free range to produce. So I hope that that's what happens with her. She says, growing up as a young black girl in Potomac, Maryland was easy. She had a rainbow coalition of friends of all ethnicities and would skip around their elementary school like the powerless version of Captain Planet's Planeteers. And finally, she says, every black film feels like it's Tyler Perry, and that just needs to stop. Is there something else besides this type of humor? I'm tired of seeing men in dresses.
Thank you for saying that, because it's a really provocative quotation, and she's nailed it. What she's getting at essentially is a sort of TV sitcom template where you would have the black character would be acting out. You know, the large black woman, you know, with the sassy remarks, if you will, and very much the sidekick character, which isn't all that different from the old studio days when you might have a supporting player who provides essentially comic relief. And what is that ultimately but tomming, if you will? There's a kind of minstrel show quality to it, isn't
there?
You
have a class that deals with this subject in great detail.
Well, I teach a course on images of African Americans in cinema, so we're really sensitive to that. And we look for examples, both good and bad, if you will, of that. But in terms of stereotypes, I actually deliberately single out stereotypical performances in terms of that kind of tomming, that kind of minstrel show. And that has such a long heritage, a rather pathetic heritage in American culture, but simply how that carries over from Hollywood studio films back in the day to some of the TV sitcoms where you have the sidekick characters. And so what she's identifying is the ongoing vitality, in this case a negative vitality, where you still have that persistent stereotype or stereotypes. And it extends beyond characters of color, a black woman in her case, but could be the gay best friend, if you will, who's there with snappy lines all the time and a snappy. And it can be very funny and this and that, but you have to like put it in context as in, well, what if we had a character who was black but not like that, or a character who's gay but not like that? In other words, who could fill, maybe even just fill another stereotype for a change, you know what I'm getting at? At least broaden the range of stereotypes. Yeah, yeah. But I think what happens is, and this is something I've noticed with Tiffany Haddish and others, is talented performers, but they get known for a particular kind of snappy comeback or image. And from a casting perspective, if I were a producer looking to clean up at the box office, I would probably press those same buttons and say, get us Tiffany Haddish, or get us a Tiffany Haddish type, and might say, hey, here's a new Issa Rae. You know, you see how that thinking works. But it perpetuates that way. And I've seen a number of Tyler, and I've got very mixed to negative feelings about Tyler Perry in that regard. I've seen all of his films released theatrically, and I know the story at this point, if you will, because so many of his films are just variations on the same basic setup. And some of those stereotypes really are risible. They're really vexing after a while. And sometimes I laugh just because funny can be funny, even when you feel guilty about laughing. You know what I mean? Like, just the setup is so stupid or so vulgar or so whatever that you just kind of laugh. But then it's like, geez, you know, you want to laugh it off or swear at it or do something at it. Even Tyler Perry, I think, well, he's made so much money at this point, he can do whatever he wants. But even he said he's getting a little tired of making Tyler Perry movies, and that in future he might retire. Medea. I mean, he's actually basically said that she'll be retired, but we'll see how long she remains in retirement. That's one of those deals. But the fact that he wants to, and he's actually, as an actor, you know, flexed his muscles and shown he's got acting ability beyond the roles he's known for. So even when people are kind of trapped, sometimes they're willingly trapped within a stereotype, right? You know, if it's good at the box office, you go to the bank with it. And I think he's done that. And now he's got enough money. And I know it's a cynical observation, but he can afford to step away from it and do other things. But I'm so glad. Back to the quote. There was a great quotation from Issa Rae that you know, she as a black woman is bothered by Tyler Perry type movies. That, you know, there's more to our life than this.
And that's why I think the photograph is such a nice offering out there. It's, you know, it's a chance to see something where it's, you know, it's regular people, actors that you like, and it's not a Tyler Perry kind of movie, although I have to say I do like Tyler Perry quite a lot.
Well, I've laughed at a lot of those and sometimes felt I should take a shower afterwards or something. And the thing about Tyler Perry is, and this is really, he's very smart about this, actually. It's a very conscious, very astute business move. He built an empire with the live shows, the word-of-mouth advertising, segueing into feature films. And the films have all done well. They really, they're low budget and big payout at the box office, if you will. And so, you know, there's a measure of admiration for that. So, yeah, I very much share your feeling that he's a great entertainer. Not all great entertaining. Well, let me rephrase this. Not all great entertainment is great enlightenment, if you will. And it's kind of a pompous thing to say, but just simply that sometimes, you know, we're capable of more, capable of better. Like, we shouldn't be coasting or slumming, if you will, to use a charged word, right? And I think, honestly, oftentimes he does that. You know, like, put the big man in a dress and uh-huh. audiences will laugh. And that goes back to Milton Berle, right? You know, put him in a dress and audiences will laugh. And I'll laugh, too, at a lot of it. And the smartest thing of all, actually, and I'm really sensitive to this, like, at what point, like, PG-13 goes to R? Tyler Perry is a master at this. He pushes to the very edge of what you can get away with in a PG-13 movie. Mm-hmm. And I think he even goes a little beyond it, but somehow still gets the PG-13. That's smart.
Yeah,
he knows exactly what to do there.
And everybody goes into his movies knowing exactly what they're going to get.
That's why you go.
That's the formula. Speaking of directors whose movies are variations on a theme,
well, before we segue, and the impossible segue, I realize, but before, let me put in a plug for a similar film I just saw yesterday by way of, you know, black protagonists who are regular people. I'm trying to think how to phrase this. Like when I say normal is such a loaded word.
Non-stereotypical
people. Thank you. I don't want to be a stereotype as I describe this. But the film I just saw is called Premature. It's an independent film. It's about a young black woman who would be about, the character would be about 17 or 18. She wants to go to college. She's living in Harlem. And without spoiling any of the story, that she's going to fall in love with a young man, slightly older, but young man. And it really is, in some ways, quintessential boy meets girl. But there are culturally specific circumstances. It is very much shot on location. It's in Harlem. And you spend as much time in the subway stations as I could call out the stops at this point. You spend a lot of time in the subway stations. And when she's home with her mother, you feel like this is a real apartment. You know, that you didn't have some art director come in and make it really clean. And nothing is computer generated here. It's human generated. And I don't want to oversell the film, but it's an independent film and really, you know, just gifted performances right down the line.
No name actors?
Not particularly big name actors, no, but that's what I like about it, is the fact that these are people that you want to get to know. And maybe they will become big names, right? But just simply a good ensemble cast. And without spoiling anything about where the story goes, it's true to life in the sense of life can be open-ended in various ways. You know, will it be a happy ending? Will boy, having met girl, fall in love and stay in love? What happens when you have issues like unintended pregnancies? And a lot of things that, you know, are so, when I say standard, I mean just in human life, things that are common occurrences. But when you have it set in Harlem with people who are non-stereotypical and things that are culturally specific by way of speech patterns, by way of neighborhood life, et cetera, that it seems fresher than it might otherwise seem simply because it's in a setting where we're not accustomed. Because this is not a quote-unquote black movie where there's going to be, you know, drug deals and shootouts and all that stuff. And it's not a Tyler Perry, you know, vaudeville routine or anything
Bench
like that.
Fest.
Yeah. It's none of that stuff. It's just like ordinary life in a real neighborhood. So the film is called Premature. And if you went to see the photograph and liked it, I think you'd like this film as well. Now let's make our impossible segue.
All right. Speaking of directors, who's you can always tell it's one of their films because they can't help but leaning on the same keys that got them famous the first time around. We're going to talk about Guy Ritchie's movie, The Gentleman.
Yeah, the former Mr. Madonna, right?
The former Mr. Madonna. And I have to say that I really liked Hugh Grant in this because it took me forever to even figure out that that was Hugh Grant. But having seen this so soon after seeing Knives Out, I felt like the script really suffered by comparison.
It's really schlocky, to cut to the chase, right? It's not a good film.
We
can say it.
We can say it?
Well,
I think we just said it.
Well, one of the problems with Guy Ritchie is it's what I call sort of the lowest common denominator fixation. In other words, if you can shoot somebody, do it at close range. If you can have blood, have a lot of blood. If you have a car chase, make it really loud and really long.
And if you have a frozen head in the freezer, show it not just once, but twice.
You got it. He's going to hire you to work with him. But the thing is, if you can have a story that's really busy but really hollow, and that's a trademark of his films. Mm-hmm. It's all surface pleasure. It's surface sensation, if you will. You have an explosion 1 minute, a car chase the next, expletives throughout, a large roster of characters. And I share your response to Hugh Grant because it actually took me a few minutes for it to fully register.
Yeah.
I was in that phase of, oh, that's Hugh Grant. That's Hugh Grant. You know, I mean, it took me I was a slow learner or something, but I was kind of like picking up speed there. And it's like, yeah, that's Hugh Grant. And I didn't get upset over that whatsoever. I actually liked that. The fact that Hugh Grant had made his reputation, his screen career, with a certain image, and he was really gifted at playing that for all it was worth. And now he's well enough into middle age that he could have just kept coasting on that, if you will, a distinguished, you know, rake of sorts. But he's now at the point where he can start to play character roles. And there are a lot of ripe characters in this film who've done good work and indeed better work elsewhere. Eddie Marzan, you have Matthew McConaughey, Charlie Hunnam. I mean, you have some gifted actors here. And here they're just kind of showboating, and I'm not putting the blame on them because that's what these characters call for. You know what I mean? Like, they are responding to what the material warrants.
The Matthew McConaughey character is every role he's ever played. He's the same guy.
And so it's easily done, and you go to the bank with your check. I mean, it works.
But he shouldn't be the star because it's such a pedestrian role for him. Michelle Dockery is totally wasted in this. It's there's not even a, after the initial, oh, it's good to have Downton Abbey back. Then you start thinking, well, it was supposed to be Kate Beckinsale, but she dropped out 2 weeks before they were going to shoot it. I think Kate Beckinsale would have been better.
But who could be good? I mean, I'm reading off names here of like actors who've done good work. Matthew McConaughey, even though he's playing a certain character type, he's done it better in better films. And Michelle Dockery, absolutely right. You get Colin Farrell, Hugh Grant, Eddie Morrison. I mean, Samuel West, to the extent that there's pleasure to be had here, it's what is simply called the pleasure of recognition, or in the case of like Hugh Grant, like delayed recognition. And as you know, plug him into a slightly different role here, but whether it's immediately recognizable or it takes you those seconds to say, oh, that's so-and-so, the fact that, you know, they are essentially here just signing on for the check, and it really is that kind of example. Nobody's stretching as an actor, but on their behalf, what would you do if this was the script you were saddled with, right? This is your character. What could you do with it?
Well, let's give a shout-out to Hugh Grant for filming his scenes in 5 days.
I want to get out of there.
Over 40 pages of dialogue within the shoot. That's a big lift.
Well, a film like this in its own way is an efficient machine, you know? And I'm not saying that as a compliment, just as a description that you say what you will against Guy Ritchie, and we've been saying it against him. he knows how to pull off a film like this, but he's been doing similar films ever since Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. That's where you have these sort of postmodernist pastiches where the people making the film don't take it very seriously, nor do we. And it's just, as I call that, sort of momentary sensation, getting a rise out of the audience. And you know, if you expect anything more from the film, it's absolutely hollow. There's nothing at the core there. So if you were one of the actors who had signed a contract to appear in this, what would you bring to the character? There's nothing to bring to the character. It's all on the surface.
It really is. I mean, there's nothing to argue with you there because you're absolutely right. Two things to look for if you decide to watch this movie, even though we've completely panned it. One is that they return to a pub in the movie called the Gritchie Brewery, there's a van outside with that on it. Gritchie Brewing Company is owned by director Guy Ritchie. Earlier in the movie, you can see the beer brand on the tap inside the bar. The pint glasses in the bar bear the name Lore of the Land, a pub owned by director Guy Ritchie with David Beckham in Fitzrovia in London. So, you know, maybe they should have just gone to the pub and talked about the movie and not made it.
Well, I often go on a rant about product placement. And this is a case where, you know, we've been holding all these aesthetic charges against Guy Ritchie, like, you know, how to make a bad movie and make money off. Because this film's done reasonably well at the box office, how to make money off of it. But this is where it starts to spill over into at least a gray zone or maybe beyond that by way of something almost unethical. You know, like oftentimes with product placement, it's simply that movies are really expensive to make. And honestly, if I were in the producer's seat and I could strike some sort of deal to place the product and actually have somebody turn the box and say, could I have some more of fill in the blank, you know, whatever that cereal is, you know, I would probably do the same thing, right? Because, you know, you make money from things like that and you cobble together a budget. So, you know, in a business sense, I understand that. But where it becomes, and so one could argue that that's not ethically the best practice, but still it's an understandable practice. Where it spills over into something else, I think, is when you're the director of the film and you actually own, you know, the pub, the beer, the whatever, and you make sure that that appears in it. I mean, that's, talk about self-dealing. I mean, if Catherine Pugh goes to jail, shouldn't Guy Ritchie go to jail for self-dealing that way? You know, it's a very unhealthy Holly situation.
It is. Do you have anything else you want to say about the movie?
Well, a lot against it, otherwise about it.
Because I was going to say that, I wanted to mention that on Monday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Columbia Arts Center, the Columbia Arts Center, you and I will be presenting on Women Pioneers in Filmmaking.
This is self-dealing I approve of.
Yes, me too. Me too. I will be talking about early film editor Margaret Booth.
And I'll be talking about Maya Deren, who was an avant-garde filmmaker. And back in the studio era, when there were very few opportunities for women to direct films, in the world of experimental film, avant-garde film, outside of the mainstream, it was at least relatively better that whether you're a female animator, director, you had more opportunities, more openings that way. And she's a really important filmmaker in terms of that history. Also in terms of feminist art. If you were studying 20th century feminist art, her name would come up. And I'll be showing her a short film by her that really speaks to, you know, her interests, Meshes of the Afternoon, that speaks to her interest specifically in psychoanalysis, but beyond that, her interest in a kind of dream narrative, a kind of storytelling that is far from the Hollywood mainstream and actually, as I said, you know, dovetails with Freudian psychoanalysis and also just simply with feminist concerns by way of a woman making a movie about a woman who's, you know, within a marriage and dealing with various issues and so on. It's a short film, so whether one likes it or not, it doesn't take up the whole evening. But hopefully the discussion will take up some of the evening because it really reminds us of, you know, the place of women in film history and whether in the mainstream or in the case of Maya Deren's Meshes of the Afternoon, somewhat out of the mainstream.
I will be talking about Margaret Booth's contributions to editing. She's one of those people that you've seen her work, you just didn't know you had seen her work, because she worked on movies such as Mutiny on the Bounty, The Goodbye Girl, and The Way We Were. So just sort of unsung heroines, I guess we should say.
Well, and ironically, of course, the fact that in classical Hollywood, the studio system, the best editing was invisible, right? Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't even notice the edit, much less know the name of the editor, whether male or female, right?
Right, that's true. They're not superstars even today, unless you've done a whole lot of stuff and
gotten a lot. Except for Thelma Schoonmaker, working with Scorsese.
But he's kind of promoted her. You know, he's made sure people knew that he worked with her all the time, and
he's,
she was a great editor and all that stuff. And Quentin Tarantino also works with a female editor, and I can't remember her name. But he likes to talk about how working with female editors is different because they don't have to win. So they're not going to argue with you about what you want to do with your movie simply to win. So that's a little quote from Tarantino for anyone who wants it. So again, that'll be Monday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Columbia Arts Center.
Tarantino said something nice about a woman?
He did. He did.
God,
yes, and he's on record.
That's our headline.
And other than that, in terms of self-dealing, don't forget to look for us on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.